Okay, so we are on the last stretch, except we're going to do a new topic for today and tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow, on Wednesday, which is social networks, which is quite nice. I think if there are few lectures that, few topics that nobody can mess up. And I think social networks are one of those, you know, it's very easy to understand what's going on. At least at the surface level, and then motivate it at any rate. So we'll look at that. Before I talk about this stuff, are there any questions? One thing that I'll send a mail about is, I believe the next Monday's class is the last class, right? Okay, so the structure of the next Monday's class would involve interactive review and summary, where you guys get to talk mostly and summarize. I'll send you more mail about it, but you know, we have to fill a whole 1 hour, 15 minutes with your summary of the class. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So these are actually slides. Most of the slides here are slides by Kentaro Toyama, who is in Microsoft Research in India. The part about India is interesting. Microsoft Research actually opened a Bangalore India branch, I think definitely less than a year back. And this guy is working there. So I picked up these slides, and with his permission, I'm using them with changes. The India part would become interesting. The connection would become apparent in a while. Okay, so let's start. The idea of what we're trying to do in today's class is social network analysis is a large topic. So yesterday, I just walked down to Borders and wanted two books on social network analysis, and they had both of them, okay? Try doing it for any computer science area in Borders, and they barely ever have any. So this is partly because social network analysis is used in many, 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 many different ways. So that's one more of the bigger areas to which we get attached to. We did it to machine learning, we did it to information retrieval, we did it to databases. Now we get ourselves attached to social network analysis. So here is kind of an interesting off-the-top motivation. The examples of social network analysis include things like analyzing epidemics, analyzing disease spread, and this person up there is Typhoid Mary, a very interesting show on that on NOVA, actually, if you guys have watched it. She was a person who was a carrier of typhoid. Virus, right? Typhoid is a virus, yeah. And she was herself not having any symptoms. And she wound up being the person that spread typhoid the most during a particular outbreak. So much so that she was considered at one point of time the most dangerous woman in US, okay? And then they put her in jail, in basically quarantine for like more than 3 years, killing her civil rights with one fell swoop. And to the extent how they figured out and how, what they had to do to figure out who is the person who is most likely to be spreading it most, winds up being a sort of a social network analysis. Who is interacting with who is interacting with who is interacting with who. And even now, you keep looking at the SARS spread a couple of years back or the bird flu thing now, it's all about figuring out what is the interaction pattern between people. Okay, this of course, several of you probably at least know the name. I thought we should see the picture too. That's the nice thing about having web. Gaetan Dugas has been considered the patient zero for the North American version of the AIDS, HIV infection. So he is the person that they found. He's back, I believe, a Canadian flight attendant. And in terms of the infection patterns, the farthest they could go to before it was no longer anybody in North America was this guy. And in the case of typhoid, the interaction patterns between Mary and the people she served, I think she was actually a cook, if I remember correctly, was fast enough that within some number of months, you know, there was a full-blown typhoid epidemic. Okay. In the case of Gaetan Dugas, he died in 1984, and the AIDS epidemic, AIDS incidence rate peaked within North America somewhat later than that. And, you know, at least in North America, they're coming down, although the rest of the world is increasing like crazy. Now, this has no connection to these. This is, of course, the infamous Florida ballot from 2000. The interesting story about this is when a guy called Mike Collins read about the infamous butterfly ballot in Florida. He was a cartoonist, but not a very well-known cartoonist. He drew this little cartoon and sent it to a couple of friends and went away for a day, okay, because he had some other things to do. And when he came back, one day later, he was a celebrity. He had something like 18,000 mails in his you know, mailbox, and a large number of people trying to get married to him, give him jobs, this, that, and he reached his 15 minutes of instant celebrity within a day, okay? And it happened because of web and internet and email, okay? All he did was he sent this little cartoon to his friends, who then sent it to their friends, who then sent it to their friends, and within a day, it was on all the networks. And this was, in fact, one of the, I don't know, have any of you seen this before? Yeah, there you go. Okay, it's one of the more enduring cartoons from that time, and there are lots and lots of fun. I mean, if you, there's a website called floridamorons.com or something from which I picked it up, and you know, there are many, many more interesting cartoons there from the 2000 thing. But the interesting part here is, within less than a day, you made you know, the spread was so fast. Okay, so the web linking and the internet linking is also, you know, so it's like social networks on steroids right now, because we are connected to each other now by email as again as physical networks. So we want to understand to some extent what are the topologies of social networks, what are the properties of them, how can we use them to our advantage. That's essentially the idea that we're trying to do. There are tons and tons of applications of network theory. Of course, we are particularly interested in the World Wide Web applications. The very fact of hyperlinking between pages is a sort of, you know, the pages by their linking generate a network. Okay. The router connectivities over the internet, collaborations among movie actors, scientists, and mathematicians, friendships. In particular, okay, who has the most number of friends in high school, sexual interaction patterns, and things like even even patterns occurring in nature, such as cellular networks in biology, other things like phone call patterns, word occurrence, word co-occurrence in the text. So you can think of two words being, you know, friendly if they keep co-occurring together, and so you can generate social network between words, and then lots and lots of other things. I think there is actually also protein interaction patterns can also be thought of, do also wind up having some of the same properties as the social network. So I'm not trying to say that words have the same sort of social interactions that people have, okay? But it turns out that some of the abstract properties of these networks, whether they are for web graph, whether they are for protein interactions, whether they are for call patterns, they wind up being quite the same. This is part of the reason why there are so many books on this stuff, you know, that are easily available right now, even for lay people. Let's see what happened. Okay, so what we want to do, in a sense, is think in terms of modeling societies of individuals as graphs, okay? So you could think of people, since we are talking about social networks, think of people as nodes, and the relations between the people as networks, as links, okay? And then, now these relations can be different relations. All I'm saying is, if the relation is a sort of a social relation, it becomes a social network. Okay, so it could be a relationship could be these two are actors and they starred in the same movie. A relation could be these two are computer science geeks and they co-authored a paper. Okay, and the relation could be that these two are high-flying folks and they spent a night together. All sorts of fun stuff. Okay, each one of these are possible different relations. And so the interesting thing is, irrespective of what the relation is, okay, some of the same patterns seem to hold in terms of the network topology, networks, macro properties. That's the interesting thing that we'll see. So acquaintance, friendship, co-authorship, et cetera, could be the kinds of relations. Now, in terms of looking at these networks, you could actually say, first of all, these could be different relations, as I said, and they can also be, you can also talk about all the changes that you do for graphs in general. You know, graphs can have directed versus undirected arcs, okay? You could have weighted versus unweighted edges, okay? So, for example, the simplest thing is it's just a graph, it's an undirected edge, and it's a nominal, okay? So it's just there's an edge and there's no edge. That's the stuff that we'll spend most time on. But many of these results also work for other sorts of things. For example, signed, that means you may have a positive relation or a negative relation with people. In fact, we talked about this, that much of the web analysis just looks at the link structure, doesn't necessarily say whether the link pointing to you is saying good things about you or bad things about you. Okay, and the same thing in citations of scientific papers. When they cite your paper, they could be saying this is one of the worst pieces of work that was ever done, and still you get a citation improvement. So it's good to write really bad papers that lots of people would improve on. Okay, but if you want to differentiate and see who are the most laughed at people versus who are the people who are being respected, you may want to look at the social network with plus and minus. Okay, same sort of a version valued where each edge has how friendly am I to a particular person. Okay, and so that would become a weighted edge. So these are actual potential variations. We won't talk too much about it. What I'm doing in the next couple of slides is to give you some of the top level properties one might be interested in talking about for social networks. And then we'll get into some neat emergent properties that hold for large networks. Okay. By the way, this guy Hahnemann, I'll send you an email on it, but this guy has an entire book on social networks on his webpage. You know, I really like what he did. I mean, he's a sociologist, of course. And you know, many of the people who originally worked on social networks were, surprise, surprise, sociologists. Okay. And this guy has an entire textbook that's on the web. And if you have questions on any of some of these definitions that you're looking at, you can go back to that link that I'll show you, that I'll send you. Now, connections. So you may want to talk about in terms of the size of the graph itself, size of the network itself in terms of the number of nodes in it, the density of the network, how many links are there given n nodes, okay? And then, of course, things like in degree and out degree. These are, again, graph theoretic notions which have obvious interpretation for social networks. Okay, in and out degree. So, in fact, the degree would be in the case where you have a symmetric relation. And for asymmetric relations, such as web citations, web linking, you want to differentiate in versus out degree. Okay, you can have large number of out degree and out links to lots of people, but you still won't be famous unless some people actually put links back to you. Okay, in other cases such as friendship, in fact, there is no difference between in and out. All you're interested in is degree. Okay, and you may want to look at these sorts of properties of social networks. You analyze them in those terms. Now again, continuing this, in terms of graphs, in terms of, you know, a network is really a graph. Okay. And in terms of graphs and networks, one of the other things that you are interested in is paths between nodes. Okay, and in particular, in social networks, you are interested in average length of a path between pair of nodes in the network. Okay, and you can talk about such things as diameter of a graph or diameter of a network, which is the largest path between two connected nodes in the graph. Okay, and the more connected the network, the smaller its diameter. The less connected the network, the larger its diameter. One of the things that people do, and in fact it will become clearer as we go on, is in the definitions of things like diameter and average path length, you always consider these averages and diameters only over the instances where they are actually paths. So for example, if you have a social network of n nodes and no edges, okay, then clearly the diameter, you know, in one way of thinking, it's infinite because nobody is connected to anybody. But another way of thinking is zero because, you know, for every pair of nodes that are connected, what is the distance? Okay, so you just look at the pairs of nodes that are connected, because in some sense that's sort of more important for lots of analysis. Okay, so you can talk about walks between nodes, you can talk about geodesic distance or the shortest distance between two nodes in terms of how many hops they have to make to go from this node to another node. Okay, and other interesting things such as maximum flow, which is basically how many of your neighbors have high connectedness to the rest of the world. If you yourself don't have high connectedness, how many of your neighbors have high connectedness to the rest of the world? Okay. Now, having those, until this slide, pretty much all these notions are straightforward, graph theoretic notions. Now, if you are really thinking in terms of these being social networks, you should somehow use these measures to talk about things that make sense in social context. Okay, and so for example, one of the important things in a social network is who is the head honcho. Okay, who is the, you know, what does it mean to talk about who is the most important person in a social network? Okay, this slide essentially is talking about some measures of centrality. Okay, in a network, in a social network, the most connected people wind up having some advantages. Okay, so the more friends you have, the more likely that you'll do interesting things. In fact, we'll look at this later. But people, in fact, because this crosses, you know, mathematics and social sciences. There are beautiful experiments that have been done in social network analysis with people as guinea pigs. Okay. There's one, for example, where this guy went to Columbia University undergrad students and asked them, you know, how many friends do you have? In terms of how many people do you know on first name basis? Okay, and they figured out the minimum, the maximum, and the average for these numbers. Okay, and one of the interesting things is actually, which we'll come back to later on, is average is not surprising. I forget the number, but average is not surprising. What is surprising is the spread between the minimum and the maximum. There were kids, apparently, in the survey who had 195 people, you know, not in the world as a whole, but, you know, I think in a short, I forget the exact setup, probably in terms of in the physical, in New York, how many people do you know as your friends on first name basis? There were people who knew 195 people, and there were people who knew like one or two. Okay, and you can clearly see, you know, the people who knew one or two probably should become computer scientists, whereas the other guys can start, you know, major businesses and will have lots of connections. Okay, so the point again is connectedness in a network does tell you something about that node. Okay, so the question is, how do you formalize the notions of connectedness? Of course, you can talk about degree. You know, what's your in degree? Okay, and what's your out degree? Just what's your degree? Okay, the node with the largest degree is in some sense connected more. Okay, obviously not really, because you have a large degree to a bunch of loser friends who themselves are not connected to anybody else, and then you're dead. Okay, so you may be in a cluster, but the cluster has no connection to the rest of the world. Right? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one. Yeah, and by the way, so many of these things, people are desperately trying to use social networks on the web right now. I mean, there are like 7 or 8 companies which, you know, I keep getting random mails from my past students as well as my current colleagues saying, I joined Friendster and I have listed you as a friend and you go join, you know. Or somebody else will say, why won't you be part of my powerful people group? You know, I already have all these great people in my list and you also be connected and you'll be part of my social network. And so there are all these things going on. I'll probably send you, Friendster is one, and I forget there's another. Orkut is another one. Yeah, so there are like a million of these and they don't actually know what they're trying to do yet. But it's clear that we do things by social network. Okay, and so people want, and then web provides, you know, an easy way of keeping track of social networks, web and internet. And so it would be interesting to see what you can do with it. The centrality measures are also important. So centrality, for example, is the distance of a node to all other nodes in the network in terms of geodesic distances. This is different from degree, right? So if you just take your average distance to every other node in the network, or your total distance to every other node in the network, you know, which is the same because for everybody it's the same number of total number of nodes in the network. Whoever has the smallest that number is in some sense more connected. They know more people faster. Okay, and then here is another different notion of centrality, which is in how many important connections are you a part of? Okay, so this one is essentially saying how close is everybody else to you. This one is saying for any geodesic path between two other nodes, what's the chance that you would be part of it? Okay, in politics, in terms of politics, people with these kinds of higher centrality measures could be kings, but most likely they're actually kingmakers. You know, they actually know and put things together. Okay. Anyway, so these are some measures, and you know, again, these are things that you can make sense from just normal day-to-day life point of view, but you also have a way of formalizing it in terms of these measures. And one of the interesting things in social networks, these are like some of the elementary measures, and one of the interesting things in this field is coming up with better measures of centrality, better measures of power, and so on, and then use that to evaluate different actors, different nodes in the network. Okay, other things that you can do with social network sphere, things like you can find a clique. Okay, I don't know how many of you heard the word clique first time in graph theory versus first time in junior high. If you heard it first time in graph theory, you really were meant to be a CS student and you had no life before. But, you know, most of us probably heard of cliques in, you know, junior high where, you know, they are all part of that clique, I'm not part of it. Okay. Cliques are obvious points in social networks where densely connected, sets of nodes. Clique is really a completely connected subgraph of a graph. Okay. But you can also talk about you can spread the definition of clique. The normal definition of clique is a completely connected subgraph of a graph. Okay. But you can also talk about more densely connected subgraphs of a graph. Now, why is this useful? In fact, on the web, there are actually several papers which try to analyze the web graph to look for communities on the web. Okay, who are pointing to each other more than you know, to the rest of the parts of the graph? Okay, there are actually several papers. One, I remember the title was very nice, Trawling for Communities on the Web. And essentially, you look at the web graph pattern and look for cliques, really. But you have to do it fast, because it's a large graph. And once you found a clique, or found something close to a clique, right, then you can actually say, what are these guys doing? Why are they so closely connected? Maybe they're all computer science geeks, maybe they're something else, maybe they're something else. In fact, one of the things that happens in these types of clique analysis in the web graph is after you find what you think is a clique, then you analyze the actual content of those pages and try to come up with what is this community really about. And in fact, one And when they actually did this on the web graphs, when their graphs were small enough size during the Alta Vista days, and you know, several other papers on this stuff was written at that time. One of the results I remember, I think, was they found a community of people who are interested in earthquake tremors off of the Japanese coast and the oil spills off of Japanese coast. So the only thing that combines these people together is their common interest in oil spills and earthquake tremors off of Japanese coast. And you wouldn't really be looking for these kinds of, you know, clique up front. However, there is a clique, and then you try to figure out what is it about, what is common between them. Okay. So, and now what can you do with it? You can do lots and lots of things. You know, but in the interesting point is, once you have a social network, for whatever relation, you can wind up having cliques on it. In the case of web graph, one of the interesting things is the relation is sort of abstract and implicit, right? If it's a social network of friendships, then a clique has an obvious meaning. These are people who are just friends, you know, closer friends than anybody else. Whereas if there are a bunch of web pages which have more connections among themselves than other pages on the network, it could be either because they all like Seinfeld, or it could be because they all, you know, want to know about the oil spills, you know, different things. Because this single link might actually have an anchor text which actually describes to you what the relation is. Okay. So that's basically the background, the very simple background of social network. The graph, and pretty much all the graph theoretic notions make sense to them in terms of paths and cliques and so on. And you can talk about measures of centrality, measures of power in terms of graph theoretic notions over the social network. So that's good enough. So now what we'll do is a couple of things which actually make, you know, I think which made a social network analysis, some of the, I guess, more non-obvious things that people figured out from social networks, okay? I guess one of the most interesting ones is the small world phenomenon. And so I'm using actually Kantor's slide here. This guy, obviously, he was a Yale grad student. He spent some time in Microsoft Research in Redmond, and then he went off with his colleague P. Anandan to start Microsoft Research branch in Bangalore. So when he went there, obviously, he would be in this funny scenario. He would go to a party, if at all there are parties that he's invited to. And he has a large number of people. He had no idea who these people are, and he's trying to figure out something common between them and him. Okay. So apparently, so he went to a party due to something, I think ASHA, I guess, actually sort of an organization. So in that organization, he met this other guy, Ranjit, and then he figured out that, in fact, even though he's so far away in, you know, a strange land, he basically has some common connection between him and that guy. Okay, so he knew Sharad. I don't know which Sharad it is, probably Sharad Malhotra, who did some of the neat work on satisfiability solvers. And he knew him from Yale, and that guy knew him from New York City. So he felt, I guess, reasonably happy. And then he realized, you know, I shouldn't have to worry too much. I do know these people, at least, in India, directly. And they know these other people. Okay? They know these other people. And all of a sudden, you notice that Kantor is connected to Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. This is the Prime Minister of India through Junjunwala, Karishma, and Kantor. So not that, you know, Prime Minister is going to take his call just because of this connection, but there is a connection, right? And then he is connected to Amartya Sen, who is a Nobel Prize winning economist from India. He is connected to Amitabh Bachchan, who is sort of like all the superstars of Hollywood combined together for India, okay? And then he's connected to all sorts of people like this. So, and he's connected to President Kalam, because it turns out that he knows this guy, Balki, who is a professor in IISc, and the President of India used to be an engineer before he became a president. He's like Carter, Jimmy Carter, I think. So that guy, in essence, knew a professor in IISc, and so through that he knows this guy. So he was feeling really happy. What's interesting to note is basically, this is the sort of thing many of us feel, that it's a small world after all, and you know, even if you don't go to Disney World and take that ride where they make you think about this, it's a small world after all, or whatever song, you still think it's a small world. And what's interesting is I tried to see how am I connected to Kentaro, other than the fact that I found his web page on Google. I mean, I basically was looking for social networks related material, and I liked this guy's slides and sent him a mail, and he was very happy to let me use his slides. And before I came here, I decided, let's see what all are the intersections between me and him. It turns out that I know Drew McDermott, who is a planning guy. So through Drew McDermott, we have a connection of two length. Okay, he knows Drew McDermott, I know Drew McDermott. I know Jhunjhunwala, he taught me communication theory as an undergraduate in IIT Madras. So through Jhunjhunwala, we have a link of size 3. Okay, and then I know Balki because I spent my sabbatical in the Institute of Science, where he's a professor, back in 1998. And so through him, of course, I know all the other people that Balki knows. So I didn't realize until today that I'm actually two links away from Abdul Kalam. Who's the president of India. I didn't realize this, but you know, I'm planning to call today. Okay, so this is reality. This is what the reality is, that we have, you know, if you look at, you know, some general notions such as nose, okay, the web is in fact a small, I mean, the world is a small world in terms of the number of nose links you have to cross to reach somebody, okay. Most people obviously were surprised when they first realized this, not just now, but long back. And so, let me see, yeah. Okay, so this is of course the Kevin Bacon game, which makes a lot of sense because this holds true for world as a whole, and so it also kind of holds true for other types of social interaction. Okay, in particular in the Kevin Bacon game, the relation is they co-starred in the same movie. Okay, and so these guys apparently invented it in 1994, and why Kevin Bacon? I have no idea. You know, I mean, in fact, we will look at variations of Kevin Bacon game for geeks, which actually started before Kevin Bacon game. I don't know whether Kevin Bacon game is not for geeks. It seems quite geekish. But, you know, there is even geekier versions of Kevin Bacon game we'll talk about in a minute. But I don't know why they decided. For other cases, the equivalent of Bacon are big guys. Like, you know, there's a mathematics, there's a version called Erdős number. We'll talk about it. And Erdős is a big guy. Kevin Bacon, you know, I don't really know why, you know, this guy is much alike. So anyway, so the question is, the goal is to connect any actor to Kevin Bacon by linking actors who have acted in the same movie. So co-starring is the relation. So X and Y are connected if X and Y co-starred in some movie. Okay? And then Y and Z are connected if Y and Z are co-starred in some other movie. And so that's the way. Okay? So obviously, there is even an oracle of Bacon.org. which I tried, by the way, and it essentially uses IMDb, which is the Internet Movie Database, to get all the movies and actors, and then it can compute paths for any random pair of actors. In the beginning, when it started, this IMDb database didn't exist, so it was a more interesting game. So people had to try in a party when, you know, everything else is over. They try and figure out the smallest distance between Kevin Bacon and any other actor. Okay. So we'll do this here, and Kentaro decided that he will connect Kevin Bacon to Amitabh Bachchan, who is an Indian actor, and interestingly enough, he found this particular path of just four. I mean, so it's a path of length 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay. So Kevin Bacon and Tim Robbins apparently acted together, and Tim Robbins and Om Puri, this guy is an Indian actor, who acted in a fair number of Hollywood movies. So they have acted together in some movies. And then Om Puri and Rani Mukherjee, who is a heroine right now in India, and reasonably popular one. And she then acted with Amitabh Bachchan in a recent movie. So there you go. What? Yes, yes. So this is the one that he gave. And it turns out that actually, if you go to Oracle of Bacon, you get a shorter link, shorter length plan, shorter length path. between, this is actually as of this morning, I asked the Oracle directly, what do you think is the distance? And so it has actually a Bacon number 3. So previously, so this idea of Bacon number first should be explained. Bacon number of an actor is the length of the path from Bacon to that actor. Length of the shortest path, of course. So according to this, you know that Amitabh Bachchan has at least a Bacon number of 4. Okay, and now normally what you want is the shortest number. The shortest such length is the Bacon number, and in fact the real one is 3. And apparently that comes through this. There is another movie which has, which was I think shot in Hollywood, so it has millions and millions of actors who act as extras or bit parts, and they wind up having other connections in other movies. And so through them, I mean obviously, I don't know any of these people, Arnie Alpert and Paul Majors, but they do exist, and they did satisfy the rule that they have co-starred, and using that link, that path, the smallest length is actually only 3. Now, it's actually an interesting point here that people might think that this path is not as nice as the previous one, because in the previous one, at least half of the class, not really half, you know, some of the Hollywood Karnashanti class could figure out the first two names, and the rest of the India Karnashanti class could figure out the other two names. And in this case, nobody could figure out any of these people other than just the first guy. Okay. So you could actually say that all paths are not created equal. I have my own reasons as to why Kentaro might have used this path as against some other path, but you know, that's a different story. Anyway, so that's Kevin Bacon game, and here are interesting interesting statistics on this. So the total number of actors in the database when he wrote this, which was I think in July time frame, is about 550,000 actors in the IMDb database. And the average path length to Kevin is 2.79. That's pretty surprising. Okay, so average path length to Kevin is only 2.79. Now again, you know, you don't take infinities into account, because if you add infinity and divide it by any number, it'll still be infinity. Okay, so if at all there is a path, then the average of all those paths is only 2.79. It turns out Kevin Bacon, not surprisingly, is not the guy with the highest centrality measure. So if you take, you know, if you sort all the people in terms of their average path length measures, okay, it turns out that Raj Steiger apparently has even lower, 2.53. And if you go to Oracle of Kevin Bacon, they have an whole entire list of people with better centrality measures than Kevin. And they also have a list of one person, they didn't want to name the actor, I don't know who this person is, who has the worst centrality measure. In terms of, you know, when he knows people with the longest possible distance. Okay, so they did this, and there are people, you know, this is putting computer science education to good use. You know, you take these kinds of databases and write nice things like this, you may come into New York Times once in a while. Okay, and in terms of closeness to the center, the rank of Kevin Bacon is 876. This, of course, reminds me of the time Charlie Chaplin took part in a Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest in Denmark, and he came in second. Okay. Now, this is a better game. It's been around probably longer than Kevin Bacon game. This is essentially Erdős number, which is Kevin Bacon game for the geeks, or more geeks than the Kevin Bacon geeks. And this one is about co-citation, that's, you know, collaborative paper. So instead of movie, you say paper. That's it. Okay, so two people have an edge between them if they were co-authors on a paper. Okay. So Erdős is interesting, is actually a very, very interesting mathematician. How many of you know anything about Erdős? Very depressing. Very, very depressing. You guys should learn more than just computer science. Erdős is one of the most interesting number mathematicians in general and scientists. Mathematicians. He's a number theorist. The interesting part about him is he had no home. He's a Hungarian mathematician who never really owned a home. What he would do is he would come to some place, say hello to the mathematics professor in that college, in that particular university, throw his bags in one of their home rooms, and work with them for 3 months, write a ton of papers, go on to the next step. And he didn't even own a checking account for the longest time. Okay, there are two great books written on biographies written on Erdős, at least one of which is, I forget the name, it's Man of Numbers or something. I'll send you a link. You should read about this guy. He's a very interesting character. Now, the most, for us, the important thing is Erdős actually wrote, just from the story, you know that he has written the maximum number of papers with other people. Okay, Kevin Bacon did not act in the maximum number of movies. Forget about maximum number of movies with maximum number of actors each. So that's why Kevin Bacon game doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, Erdős, on the other hand, actually wrote 1,500 plus papers with 507 co-authors. He had no students, no home. All he had is his little suitcase. He died less than 7 years, 6 years back. Okay, very interesting guy. What? Okay, that's probably the reason. Okay. And so anyway, so mathematicians, because when he wrote enough of these papers, they started realizing that, you know, it would be interesting to see social network analysis of mathematicians. And one way to motivate it is to, I mean, the social networks can exist without a particular guy being given a name, saying this is the Kevin Bacon game. Even if you don't call it Kevin Bacon game, if you call it Amitabh Bachchan game, it still is the same thing, okay? The important graph is co-starring graph. And similarly, even if you don't call it Erdős number, you call it Rav number, it's the same graph. Now, as long as Rav is one of the nodes in the, you know, paper, math, CS-related papers, that's fine, okay? But this sort of gave interest to mathematicians, and so again, you know, since these are mathematicians, after all, they spent a lot of time trying to analyze the properties of this graph, and they found that, and so you can go to Oakland site for the Erdős numbers, and all computer scientists and all mathematicians and many computer scientists will put on their web page their Erdős number, okay? Erdős number is 0 for Erdős himself, 1 for all the 507 people that he wrote papers with, and 2 for anybody who wrote papers with these guys and so on. Okay, and one of the interesting things they found is, if you look at only the mathematicians, the average length of this path is 4.65. And they even found that when there is a path at all, it's not more than like 10 or something. Okay, so everybody is, if at all you are connected, if you have a chance of being connected to Erdős, then the path cannot be more than 10. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, maximum is 13 actually. That's good. Okay. So that's Erdős number. And so that's how Erdős number looks. He is Erdős, Mike Malloy, Dimitri Sakilopoulos, and Bernard Shoff, Andrew Blake, and himself. So that's how, that was his claim to fame. So obviously, since it's my class, I need to put one for myself. And I had no clue what my Erdős number was until this morning. Okay, I didn't care, but I wanted to find out today, since it cannot be just for Yamastak. So I went to mathsci.net, which has a large number of papers, authors, and citations and authorship. And so you just give the name. I think there's a previous slide where, I mean, previous screen where you give, you know, Erdős and your name. In fact, you can give any two names, you know. And they know most people use it for Erdős, so they even say, if you don't know how to spell Erdős, click this button. We'll spell it for you. Okay. So I just found that my Erdős number is 4, which is, in fact, better than Toyama's. So at least there's one guy who I'm better than. Now, this is probably a more interesting number. This is a Turing number of Rav. That's 7. And the only reason we are talking about Rav rather than you is I'm giving the lecture. You go home and you can do it too. But first, try to write a paper. Otherwise, you know that you have no such numbers. Okay. So you'll notice, for example, that my connection to this mathematics world seems to be to Dana Nau, who was a committee member in my PhD, who I wrote a paper with after I came to ASU. And so that winds up being my best connection to both Erdős and to Turing. Okay. What is this? So this whole thing actually, caught public consciousness some years back, actually long time back, 1967, when a guy called Stanley Milgram did this following experiment. Social scientists do experiments, and they do experiments on people, okay, unlike you guys. So what he did was he took random people, apparently from Nebraska, and gave them a letter to each of them. And they were all supposed to send this letter to a particular stockbroker in Boston. Okay? By giving this letter only to somebody that you know. This was before terrorism alerts and so on, where, airport people will say, did anybody put anything in your bag that you don't know about, all that stuff, People would let you take anything. In fact, I had gone to places, I had gone to especially India, where at the airport there would be these people who would say, can you take this for my mother in India? And I'll just take it. Okay. Now I can take it and go to jail directly. So anyway, so these guys were only allowed to give these letters to people whom they know by first name basis. And so the question is, what he wanted to do was to find out what is the number of halves these letters made. Okay, and what they found was among the letters that did go to the target, the average number of links was 6. So being a guy who knows how to make news, he wrote this whole thing called 6 degrees of separation. The world is a really connected place, and the distance between you and somebody else is on the average only 6. And in fact, the little known fact is most of the letters were lost. This is for those that actually did make it, and it was 6. Okay. Now, the ideas that came out of this study were actually true, even though this experiment did was to give a nice spin to this. Okay. If you did the same thing, we'll do for the rest of the class. We'll be actually doing some of these small world phenomena on random graphs. Okay. And people don't, New York Times is not likely to send their reporter and write an article in the front page if it involves just a bunch of notes you made up with a bunch of edges you made up. Okay, whereas they're much more likely to take this, even though this might be a shoddy experiment. Anyway, so he did this, and I think it's part of popular culture. There is a play on 6 degrees of separation, and it became part of the common vocabulary of people. Okay. So here is my question. So it's clear that somehow in many social networks there is this notion of small worldness, that is the average length of paths between any pair of nodes seems to be very small despite the size of the network. So the question is there a way in which you can formally explain this? So is there a model of the world that you can come up with such that for that model of the world, this is the way it would be? And then what you would have to do is you just have to convince yourself that the model of the world you have is the way the world actually works. And so you should not be surprised that a property that you just empirically found, it's not surprising to you because it actually also comes from this model. Okay, so the first thing, of course, is to find what happens on random graphs. If you just have social networks, suppose were random graphs. Okay, of course it's not random. We'll talk about all sorts of other models, but let's start with random graphs and see is it surprising on random graphs. Now, the reason it's worth looking at is that the large number of things that are true just because of random processes that people are always very surprised at. Okay. A classic case is the birthday paradox, which most of this lecture was an elaboration of the fourth mail I sent to the class in the beginning of the semester. Okay. So the birthday paradox essentially is if there are a group of people in a room, n number of people in the room, what should be the value of n such that there is a probability greater than p that a pair of these people would have the same birthday. So you know, obviously, that there can only be 365 different birthdays, right? So the question is, how many people should there be in the room before, first of all, the probability that a pair of people will have the same birthday is greater than 0.5. Turns out it's like something like 90. Okay, and you can just do this from elementary probability theory. By the time the room has 60 people, the probability that a pair of them have the same birthday is 0.9999999. Okay? And this is surprising to a lot of people. Okay? It should not be surprising, because it's exactly what you expect it to be if you understand anything about probability. Okay? So the question is, should small world phenomena also be the similar to birthday paradoxes? In the sense, they're just obvious if it's a random graph. Okay? Not surprisingly, in fact, one of the best papers in this area was written by Erdős and Reni, and Erdős is the same Erdős that we are talking about, Paul Erdős. And so they looked at random graphs, and they looked at, they analyzed them in terms of basically as connectedness of these random graphs. Okay? Now, here is the notion of a random graph. A random graph essentially is you choose a number n, so you put n dots, which are n number of nodes. Now, for any pair of nodes, you pick, you would put a link between them with a probability p, and no link with a probability 1 minus p. Okay, so you have a p coin, which will come heads with probability p and tails with probability 1 minus p. Okay, so you pick a pair of nodes, toss the p coin, and if it says heads, you put a link, otherwise you won't. Clearly, if p is 0, there is no links at all. And if p is 1, you have a complete graph, everything is connected to everything. Okay, so the question is, what sort of interesting things can you say for different values of k? Where k actually is the average induced degree of this random graph. Okay, so the important parameters are p and n, that's it. N is the number of nodes, and p is the probability. And it turns out that the average degree of the nodes would be, the k would be, is approximately going to be equal to p times n, where n is the number of nodes. Okay. So what can you say about these things when n tends to infinity? And there are three graphs here. One is the disconnected one, where p equal to 0. The other is a complete graph, where p equal to 1. And so, of course, the degree is approximately n squared by 2. Okay? And this one is set in such a way that its average degree is 1. Okay, so you pick the probability 0.09 for which the average degree winds up equal to 1. So the question is, for these graphs, and in fact, that middle thing has been split into an indegree of 0.5 and an indegree of 1. In and out, these are undirected graphs, so you just are considering an indegree. Okay? So for these, you want to ask the size of the largest connected cluster in the graph, the diameter, which is the maximum path length between the nodes of the largest cluster, the largest connected cluster, and the average path length between the nodes, if there is a path. For all of these, of course, you know, you're looking only when there are paths between these. And this is how it looks like. Okay? So the interesting thing is, when p equal to zero, the size of the largest component is 1, because everybody is a component by themselves, okay? And the diameter of the largest component is 0, because I say infinities don't count. If you are not connected, then you just, nobody is connected to anybody, you will just assume that the diameter is 0. And the average path length is also 0. Which again, average path length between the connected nodes is 0. Now on this other end, when p equal to 1, the size of the largest component is the same as the size of the graph, right? Because it's a completely connected graph. And then the degree of the diameter of the largest component in a complete graph, what's the diameter? What's the largest distance between any pair of nodes? 1. That's the whole definition of a complete graph. because everybody is connected directly to everybody else. Okay, and then the average path length is also 1. Now the interesting stuff happens here in the middle. The interesting stuff happens in the middle, and so for k equal to 0.5, you notice that the diameter is 4, okay, and the average path length is 2. This is all for n equal to 12, by the way, for n equal to 12. And for k equal to 1, where p is 0.09, if you put p equal to 0.09 for n equal to 12, then k will be equal to 1. That's the basic idea. For that, you suddenly notice that the largest component previously was 5. Largest component was 5 1 here. It was 5 here. It became 11. And the largest component at most will be 12. So it jumped in the small range of values per k between 0.5 and 1. It jumped almost close to the highest value. Furthermore, the degree, the diameter of the largest component has now become 7. This is interesting. Okay, so the diameter here is lower. Diameter here is lower. It's higher here. Okay, how many of you remember this stuff on phase transitions for satisfiability problems? Okay, people who took course with me should remember. It's basically you should have this in the back, that in the back of your head. Same thing, same sort of situation occurs there too. Okay. So the middle is where the hard problems live. Okay. And the middle, of course, is defined differently. For in the satisfiability problems, the parameter of interest is the number of clauses divided by the number of variables for a three-sat problem. And where the magic ratio 4.3 is the important place. Before 4.3 and after 4.3, the problems are easy to solve. One side, they're easy to solve because there's no solution. Another side, they're easy to solve because there is a solution all the time. And exactly around 4.3, it's way darn hard to solve them. Okay? So that was the critical parameter for satisfiability. For random graphs, in terms of these notions of diameters, as well as the component size, the critical parameter winds up being k, which is connected to p and n. Okay? And where k is close to 1 is when bad things happen to the graph, in terms of things are farthest apart. Okay, so it actually, this is exactly what I'm showing there. So if you look at k path, k is drawn this way, and you have two curves here. This curve is the diameter curve, and this curve is the component size curve. Component size cannot be more than the maximum component, which is the length, which is equal to n itself. So if you write it in terms of normalized fashion, component size becomes close to the largest size very fast after k equal to 1.0. Before it, it is close to this size. The same thing for the diameter, on the other hand, diameter kind of peaks here and goes this side and this side. This and this side is easier. Okay, smaller diameter. Now, the interesting thing about this is it's a phase transition. It's a phase transition. Okay. For those of you who haven't thought about phase transition in a long time, I mean, anybody who took my courses would have remembered it. But the point about phase transition is change is not gradual. Okay. So the idea, when was the last time you heard about phase transition in your life? Not just in computer science. If you boil water, it has a phase transition. Right? Now, what's interesting about phase transition of boiling water? The fact that water becomes vapor, that's not going to just happen at the phase transition. Water is always turning into vapor. At room temperature, it's turning into vapor. Okay? Lower than room temperature, it's slowly turning into vapor. What happens is, at 100 degrees centigrade, all the molecules of water, at the same time, want to turn into vapor. Okay, so the rate of turning into vapor just peaks humongously right at 100 degrees centigrade. And until everybody has a chance to turn into vapor, the temperature doesn't increase anymore. That's the interesting part about phase transition, not the fact that water becomes vapor. Okay, and so whenever you have a phase transition, you have to have a curve like this, which has a sharp peak. Okay. So from the point of view of the satisfiability problem, if you look at that magic ratio, which is num clauses by num variables, okay, nobody is surprised that if the number of constraints in a satisfiability problem is much fewer than the number of variables, then any variable can take any value. This is satisfiability problem. You're all supposed to know, you know. So any variable can take any value, and it's easy to solve. Okay? And on this end too, there are too many clauses and too few variables, and so mostly you are not likely to be able to satisfy the clauses. Okay? And so the problem won't have a solution, but you will find it very fast. So it's obvious that if you draw the cost of computing, you know, doing this problem, you know that it sort of has to go like this. You know that this side it has to go down, this side it has to go down. What is surprising is it comes like this, goes like that. This part is 4.3 for the number of clauses, number of variables. And for random graph in terms of diameter, this part is, has a different parameter, k, which is the average degree, and that's one. In fact, there's the same sort of ideas that are there also for random graphs in terms of Hamiltonian circuits. You know Hamiltonian circuit for a graph, right? So what is the probability that there is a Hamiltonian circuit for a random graph? And how hard is it to find it? Remember that the extremes, when they definitely there is no solution, and you can prove it that there is no solution, are that there is definitely any random tour is a, any random cycle would be a Hamiltonian cycle. Those are cases where you can solve it easily. It's in the middle where you have to go through all possible enumeration to figure out. Okay? And that too will have a phase transition. So in some sense, phase transition is bigger than even social networks. It crosses problems. Okay? And you know, so anyway, for coming back to our specific problem, for random graph, phase transition occurs for k equal to 1. How does this help us in explaining small world phenomena? What is k? K is the average degree. Think of knowing relation. I know somebody by first name. What do you think is the average value of I know somebody, I mean the number of people somebody knows over any population? Less than 1, equal to 1, much greater than 1. Much greater than 1. That's all you need to know. Because phase transition occurs here. In fact, from the point of view of small world phenomena, you don't really care that even phase transition occurs. All you care is above 1, you pretty much are going to have small diameters. Below 1, you're going to have small diameters too. But the world that you live in is going to have above 1, k above 1. And so if the world you live in is actually random graph, so if the social networks in the world are random graphs, then it's no darn surprise that there is small world phenomena. It's not at all surprising. Okay? And in fact, Erdős and Renyi showed that the average path length between the connected nodes is this formula, Lan and Valandre. That's why, you know, he's a number theorist and I'm just a computer scientist. So they actually analyzed this and, you know, figured out a bound. Nice. Good. This is good. This should at least explain to you that small world phenomena is not applied. How does it? What's the problem with this argument? Is your social network random? Do you, when you walk into your class, you pick another node and say, okay, toss a coin whether I'll be friends with them or not. And then if the coin says, yes, you should be friends, you'll be friends, otherwise you won't be. Is that the way your social network is generated? Do you know anybody whose social network is generated that way? Right? I mean, at least if they do, people exist that way, they don't admit. Okay? So the problem is the model is the wrong model. Real networks are not random networks. Now, in what ways are they not random networks? And more importantly, what we want to know are what are the specific important differences between networks that correspond to real networks and networks that correspond to randomly generated networks, where random generation is by the formula before. Okay, now, before I go there, let me explain to you one other important thing, which is you could have, just when people say random, everybody thinks they understand what random means. Okay, but you know that random requires distribution. If I don't say anything, you just assume random means uniform distribution. Okay? The loser in the previous argument is that real world does not correspond well to random uniform networks. Okay? Grades are provided supposedly on a random curve, right? And you don't think it's randomly provided. There is some connection to how you did in the course and your grade. And it's connected with respect to the distribution, normal distribution, you know, if you believe in the policy there. So the question is there a better distribution with respect to which the real world is generating its network? So we are talking about intelligent design theory, except emergent intelligent design theory, in terms of, is it the case that most real world networks can be shown to be closer to networks that would have been randomly generated by a different distribution other than uniform distribution? You can still have random, except the distribution is different. And I want to know that. That's the point I want to understand. And it's important to realize that difference, because what used to happen in the SAT problem was people would make this, again, I'm changing tracks. In SAT problems, you know, satisfiability problem is one of the important problems in computer science, and everybody was trying to make solvers for satisfiability problems. And how do you test your problem, your solver? The way you would test would be randomly generate problems. Now, if you don't know anything better, when you randomly generate 3 SAT problems, what's the likelihood that most of your problems will be here? Very small. And so people would generate randomly generated SAT, people will make these SAT solvers, take a randomly generated mix of problems, which by definition, if you know anything about how SAT problems work, are actually very easy to solve, and they are just basically patting themselves hard on the back, saying, wow, you know, these stupid computer science people are saying it's NP-hard problem, but look, mine is sublinear performance. Right? And so in fact, in SAT problems, when people realized that hard problems live here, then they started generating random 3 SAT problems whose number of classes by number of variables is approximately 4.3. Then they started giving it to these other guys who are patting their backs silly, and they were all dead on arrival, because most of the time they're doing well because most of their problems were here and here. And when the truly the hard problems came, they had no clue. Okay? So random doesn't mean anything unless you talk about distribution. Most of us just assume random means something. That's because we assume random means uniform. That's a wrong assumption. So that's what you want first, you know, change that. You know, lobotomize yourself. Okay. So here are 2 random networks. This is uniform random network. And this is a network that corresponds more closely to the kind of networks that people see in the world. You know, whether it is networks in terms of web page connectedness, whether it is in terms of people being friends with other people, whether it is in terms of joint co-citations and so on. Both are random graphs. The important difference is in this random graph, pretty much all nodes are sort of created equal. They all have approximately the same degree, which is close to the average degree. This, on the other hand, has some nodes which are quite rich and some nodes much poorer. Okay? So it's just a distribution difference. Okay. So random network models introduce an edge between any pair of vertices with a probability p, but the real world networks normally tend to have relatively few nodes of high connectivity. In fact, if the real world networks do not have some nodes of high connectivity, I would say that some of the most important things you learned in this course would have not been true. Page rank would not mean anything if everybody has the same page rank, right? Okay. So the very reason that page rank has any effectiveness is because the real world web networks have distribution of, the degree distribution, which is not uniform. In fact, the in versus out is what we are distinguishing there. But, in degree in particular is very different. And now authorities hubs take both in and out. And there are hubs, there are authorities, there are losers. Okay, you could be neither high in degree nor high out degree. Okay, so these are the kind of networks that seem to come up more often in real world. And these have been called scale-free networks. And the important thing about these networks is the following. This is a mathematical fact about most real world networks that has been found empirically. In the sense, you would analyze the networks that people have found either on the web or on friendships or on, whatever you want. Okay? And what did I analyze here? I analyzed the degree distribution. The degree distribution. Okay? And so for different degrees, what's the probability that a node in the graph has that particular degree? Okay? And it turns out that if the graph is made randomly, uniform random connectivity, then you get this, which looks very much like a sort of a normal curve. Actually, it's a Poisson distribution, which is sort of close to the discrete equivalent for normal distribution. Okay, this is what you expect. You don't expect everybody to have exactly the same degree. You just expect that there is a mean degree around which most of them are centered, and the outliers are far away. This looks like your B or C grade here, your A plus is here, your C minus is here. That's what you expect. If you were to take any real world graph, and in fact this happened in 1999, there's a guy called Barbasi who was a physicist in Notre Dame, essentially said, look, until then they didn't have a good idea of how to get a large scale social network. Building a large scale social network of friends of people in the world, okay, or even a large part of the world, by asking them and writing down this stuff is like census. And we only do census like once in 20 or 30, 10 or 20 years. It's too costly. Web, on the other hand, people already individually put links to their, to the pages that they like. So when web came along, this guy decided, hey, look, this is a network that people evolved. So let's see, by getting the graph of connectivity between pages, let's see whether the degree connectivity is like this or not. Okay, so what he did apparently, this guy, was that he had a student, this Rekha somebody, she was almost getting done with her PhD, and she already wrote papers that came in Nature and so on, and then she had a coffee with her and said, look, you should give up on your current PhD, you should do a different PhD, and we should do this thing, we should analyze the web graph as a social network, okay? And she agreed for some reason, and they did this work where they could make a pretty convincing argument that the degree distribution was more like this. Okay, that means a few nodes have very high degree and every other node has very low degree. Now this is called a power law distribution. That means if you were to fit a curve to this, you can fit it in terms of a k power minus r sort of a curve, where r is the exponent. Okay? And for most real-world networks, they seem to follow power law phenomena. They seem to follow power law phenomena. Okay? We will actually explain why it makes sense to have power law phenomena in a kind of a roundabout way. But they do seem to follow power law phenomena. And in particular, the stuff that many of the people have shown till now is most real, actually existing networks seem to be, you can fit them with R values between 2 and 3. So it's like either square or cube in between. Falling either as a square or falling as a cube or in between. And for web graph, even after this, for Bassi and Co., web graph they did for the large scale web graph of Alta Vista, the same thing that gave you the bow tie, remember? That in the very beginning of the semester. Okay. For that, they did analysis and found that the in degree distribution can be fit with R equal to 2.1. This is not the degree itself. This is the rate at which it falls as, you know, k power minus 2.1. And the out degree falls as k power minus 2.7. That looks like a nice idea. But in fact, many, and this is for web, and they've shown it for all sorts of other, I think. I'll just show you one more slide and we go home. So this is the slide I want to show you. That social networks, protein interaction networks, sexual interactions between people, computer networks, World Wide Web citation patterns, all of these seem to have power law distribution in terms of k. So remember, I was asking, maybe we were looking at the wrong random distribution. I want a better random distribution. Well, here is a better random distribution. What if I were to generate my graphs such that their emergent degree distribution would have a power law behavior? You notice that I'm basically saying, I know the answer should be power law. What should I do for the graph such that the answer should be a power law? Now, here are things that you can do for which you definitely will have power law distribution. And I point those out because they make sense for most of, for example, web networks. So power law distribution of node will arise, node degree will arise if, and it's not only if, these are not the only conditions where power law distribution will arise, but for these you can show that power law distribution will arise. Okay? One is, edges are added in proportion to the number of edges a node already has. That means if when you get up, you start being friendly with popular people more than unpopular people. So as the node comes in, you know, this is sort of like junior high phenomenon. I mean, you go into junior high and you want to make connections with the popular kids. And, you know, so that's the way. You don't randomly select somebody and say, oh, yeah, you mean your friend. To the extent there is a randomness to this. An alternative model, this will give you power law distribution. If you just do this, if you just make so the probability of you having an edge to a node be proportional to the degree of that node already. This is the whole idea of rich get richer. Popularity begets popularity. Fame begets fame. And the very fact that we have these proverbs and no proverbs of the form rich get poorer or popular people become unpopular means that these are, you know, what are proverbs but some form of fuzzy collected wisdom. We see this in social networks. Okay? An alternative, which actually makes even more sense for web, is when a new node is introduced into the graph, all it needs to do is the following. It picks a random node and copies a random subset of its connection and then does anything more. The moment you do that, things which already have connections wind up having more connections. This is classic. I mean, CNN has most popular articles on the left-hand side. If some article winds up being one more than, they put top five most popular articles, right? And so these are, if one article there winds up being just one click more than the, sixth most popular article, it makes it into the top five, then all of you will click on it. So it becomes even more popular. right? Okay, it's like obvious. That's basically the way, you know, popularity begets popularity. And so the copy model, where the new node copies a random subset of the links of an existing node, this is sort of close to web reality. So if the web graphs were to be generated by these random models, they will have, if graphs were to be generated by these models, they will have power law distribution. And so the nice thing is then you can prove properties about graphs which are made by these patterns, and those should also give you ideas about how the real world works. Okay? We'll spend more time on this stuff and also connect it back into what we can do with this in the web. Yes. No, no, no. So you have to understand this. No, no, no. This is a very good point, and make sure you understand this. What we are talking about here is not, there are two different parameters. Parameter one is the probability that you would make a link to another random node in the current network. The uniform random networks basically have one single coin, and they toss it. And if it says heads, you will make a connection, otherwise you won't. If they just do this, see, locally, each guy is not going to know. See, this is an emergent phenomenon. If individual nodes put links to the rest of the network just by tossing a coin, then the emergent network's average degree will have this distribution. Okay? So if the world were to be A, it would have the property B. Not B is what I'm showing when I showed actually real world networks have this as the in-degree distribution. A implies B, not B implies not A. That means the world is not actually uniform random model. Now what should the world be such that it would have this? That's what I was explaining to you later on. Do you see what I'm saying? And those models, the ones that I showed, they would lead you to this. It's like, you know, Excel saying goal seek behavior. I want this as the goal. What do I do locally such that the emergent behavior would be this? Why is it called safety network? I don't actually remember. I think in the link that I sent you, it was there. It's something to do with this guy, Barbasi, who in essence said to the extent that this property is sort of independent of the size of the network. This property is independent of the size of the network. Okay? We'll come back and continue next time.